So just while colleagues are seating themselves, perhaps I'll do a quick sort of whistle stop introduction to what we do at this stage of the conference. It's become a bit of a tradition over the last while to close with a panel. And for some reason, I seem to be the traditional panel convener. And it's always a pleasure and it's always a principle, you know, to be here, to actually close out the work that's actually being done. So you have the full biographies of the various candidates who are with us here today to speak. You have all of that in the conference programme, so I'm not going to labour that overly. I will say that we're very appreciative of the fact that each has agreed to speak for a very short piece of time, so 3 minutes, after which I start throwing things at them, 4 minutes after which I push them off the stage. I've not had to do it yet, but I'm ever hopeful. So effectively, what each will do is address the theme of the conference, giving us a couple of nuggets, a couple of ideas to think about, a couple of points that they wish to make that they see are particularly important, after which we will have the open floor. And it is basically an open floor. So please make a few notes as people speak, questions that you wish to raise. It is your opportunity to put questions directly to the panel, to all or any members. So you can ask a general question to the full panel or a specific question to a particular member of the panel. Now, because our keynotes have already spoken at some length to the conference, we don't ask them to stand up and speak again at this particular point. So from this rogues gallery sitting here in front of you, the people who will actually speak will be Sam Gallagher, who's the Chief Executive of the General Teaching Council of Northern Ireland. Sam brings a lot of diverse leadership skills to bear. He's worked in health services. He's worked across the spectrum of public services generally. So he'll be speaking to leadership from that perspective, perhaps. Dr. Margaret O'Donovan, the twins. Are you both here? Yeah. I apologise for the slight misprint in the programme. There is only one inimitable Dr. Margaret, and she's joining us here. Margaret works in a number of institutions, and she also works with the development group that are currently leading in the South on the whole area of developing leadership in schools. So it'll be interesting to hear her perspective again in this very topical and controversial area. Then we have Lady Rosemary Salisbury, who is a teacher, ex-teacher, freelance, serial beginner of PhD projects and so on and so forth. And I'm really looking forward to hear what Lady Rosemary's got to say. I think she brings a rather interesting inside-outside sort of perspective to what we're doing, and that will be very useful to us. Dr. Joe Moynihan then. Joe's been involved in UCC, particularly on the education leadership side, so I'm not going to say he will speak to the academic. I think he's his own man, he has his own mind in this area, but he will perhaps bring to the front some of what we've been struggling with in relation to accreditation issues and so on in regard to leadership across the school systems. And then, as I say, we have our two esteemed keynotes who need no further introduction, perhaps, Professor Marilyn Corcoran-Smith and Professor Paul Miller. That's it. The rules of engagement are pretty straightforward. As I say, the speakers speak in turn as per the programme. Each one will speak very briefly. And as I say, hopefully this will not be the time that I have to actually push someone off the stage. But, you know, I'm ever hopeful in that regard as well. So that's it. First speaker, please. Sam Gallagher, you're up and your time starts now.
Okay, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you very much for the opportunity to come and speak to you today. I found the conference to be very encouraging today in terms of the theme around leadership. And in coming to my particular role in the last year into education and looking at really about the development of the profession from a professional body and working with the likes of colleagues in TCNI and see the way the work is going. This increasingly focused coming now on the importance of leadership within education. And you look at the minute and think, you know, the view within schools sometimes that leadership is outside of the classroom. In other words, that the career path of a teacher moves you into away from the classroom into, if you like, organizational leadership or head of department or, for example, head teacher and so forth. But really this focus of within promoting professionalism, that actually leadership begins with the individual and leadership begins with the teacher. And one of the things quite clearly you see through in the North through the learning leader strategy and things that is a recognition of, if you like, the need for good capacity building within the profession around what it means to be an educational leader. And, you know, I'm a great advocate for the work that we've done in other areas in healthcare, et cetera, around a competence-based approach to professional development. So what is it the core competencies around leadership that teachers need to have? How would those competencies show themselves? What's the values and behaviours that underpin that? And then how does that competency be acquired? And that those competencies being acquired is not just from attending a course, but more importantly about this whole concept and the link through to reflective practice. So if you think about it, if you think the core tenets of leadership, of things like vision, of purpose, you spoke about Paul, moral purpose, about empowering, about the culture, creating a culture of values and the environment in which you work, and then being outcome focused. Why are we doing this? What's the outcome you want to achieve through leadership? And then the other aspects to it, which is makes people feel a wee bit maybe uncomfortable about, which is really holding to account. And one of that's holding to account yourself as an individual teacher in terms of what I'm doing in my class with my students. So those sorts of things of taking those and defining as competencies and then things, how do I acquire the skills that are necessary to be able to do those kinds of things? But I found it very, very encouraging. I think this whole drive back towards professional ownership of what it means to be a teacher and being a professional, that I own this and I own my practice and I have a responsibility to develop my practice, that continuing professional development is something inherent that I have to do. And importantly then what goes along with that of having done that, that there is the degree that I'm accountable. I'm accountable to the children I teach, I'm accountable to my community, I'm accountable to my organization. So, you know, I think this whole concept of leadership isn't going to go away. I think it's a theme that will continue to develop, and you'll see it reflected in not just the work that, you know, Teach and I do, but the TCI and other organizations are doing, and into teacher education itself. So those are just my view.
And you have exactly 3 seconds left if you want to add any further. That's well done, well done. A very good start indeed. Thank you. I'll try dismissing it. It's kind of yeah. Okay. Thanks. And you've given us a lot to start off there with in terms of the concepts of the core, concepts of practice, issues of ownership, and so on. And I'm sure colleagues will want to chase some of those down at the very least. Next up, our next speaker is Margaret. And again, Margaret, the floor is yours for exactly 3 minutes.
Thank you very much. And good afternoon, everybody. And delighted to be here and to share some thoughts and some ideas with you this afternoon. What I will speak about, and just throw out some questions maybe and some rhetorical questions that we might consider and have a think about, I'll just develop a little bit on a presentation that Joe and I did here yesterday afternoon, where we're looking at learning and teaching and the extent to which principals in the voluntary secondary schools in the Republic of Ireland enable collaborative practice, and building around that whole idea of collaborative practice, developing the leadership capacity that Sam spoke about, developing school development, school leadership, the place of the teacher as leader in the classroom, as leader of learning, and as having an ownership of that learning. But it's to take it then to the level of the principal and where that leaves the principal as an enabler or otherwise of collaborative practice within the schools. There are challenges, as the title of our workshop says, challenges for educators, challenges for school leaders, particularly in the context of voluntary secondary schools, where we're coming from a very much an isolationist culture, which pertained historically because of the particular contextual frame of the voluntary secondary schools, where you have an isolationist culture where teachers operated individualism behind the closed door. So looking then, relating that and linking that with the looking at our school's document 2016, where there's a focus and a policy, rhetoric, a change in rhetoric, a change in discourse, a mandate really for collaborative practice, for opening up the professional dialogue and the professional learning. And our research would indicate that principals are very much supportive of this collaborative model, would see it as very new, as an emergent concept. However, the challenges are about crossing boundaries, and I come back to the title of this conference, Leadership Across Boundaries. And the boundary I'm talking about in this context is crossing the threshold of the classroom door. How does the principal have that dialogic conversation with teachers about the learning in the classroom? And one of the main barriers that was identified was the fear, resistance premised and based on fear, fear of evaluation rather than with an engagement with the process. But the fear was two-pronged. I think the fear also was evidenced by the principals who were afraid of damaging relationships, of that whole relational aspect of the dynamic between teachers and principals in the school. So the fear was pretty much applied to the teachers and led to resistance, but a fear in principals to engage with that process, perhaps as they would have liked. It's also an interrogation by the principals of how they would refract these deeply embedded subjectivities and taking care of the emotional identities and the emotional subjectivities indeed of the participants, of the teachers. So that's one of the boundaries, and I'd like to maybe throw that out and you might reflect on it during the course of this session. What does that mean for you in your context? How are those boundaries, which were very preset, as Paul spoke about earlier, these preset defined boundaries, how are they made more fluid? How are they opened? How are they navigated within your context? Done?
One final point.
So that's what I would ask you really to reflect on, and maybe we'll have a conversation about that. And how can school organisations or any organisation or your organisation facilitate this emergent mode of practice in your school or in your organisation as a learning organisation? So how to create that culture of collaboration and aligning the different perspectives, brokering maybe and opening up new possibilities of meaning and participation in the communities.
That's great. Our next speaker now is Dr. Margaret O'Donovan. No, she was trying to get 6 minutes. We all saw what she was at, but we're not falling for that.
Three.
No, you haven't. Not this time. Thanks very much, Margaret, indeed. And that gives us a lot to think about also, the concept, I think, there of that the learning organization is one that we're interested in, the notions of boundaries and how they're crossed. Nothing new to this particular discussion, to this particular conference. Concept of the secret stories that we've heard coming up a number of times in different fora at the conference, also lovely stuff to keep us going. Lady Rosemary.
Hello. Thank you for inviting me here. I've had a very interesting day and a half. As you can see, I've been around a long time, and I would consider myself to be from the sharp end of the whole process. I was a substantive head in two post-primary schools, and then I was asked to sort out in one way or another four and amalgamate two schools in. So the first school was in Bradford, the amalgamation was Hull, and then the third one was Doncaster, and then the East Riding of Yorkshire. I felt incredibly privileged to be part of the school improvement movement at the University of Nottingham. When I was a deputy in a large city school in Nottingham, we worked very closely with the University of Nottingham on all sorts of projects. And then they persuaded me to start the taught doctorate, which I did for 2 years until I became a head and then decided I couldn't do both. But the what I had learnt over those 2 years of research and working with people like David Hopkins, Alma Harris, Chris Day, and their friends Mel West and Mel Ainscoe Hargreaves, it was so much a learning curve and gave me enormous confidence to take on the role of headship. And as researchers, it's very important to remember that. Your work needs to have impact, and this certainly did for me. I always had a passion for learning and teaching, and it was certainly encouraged by those people. Inspirational teachers do transform lives. I'm a living example of it. So every school I took over was an underachieving school, or in a couple of cases, failing schools. And they all had one thing in common, poor leadership, which led to disillusioned, demoralized staff and disengaged students. So I felt, and it developed over the years, I thought you might like to hear a simple example of how one change took place. So I was going into these schools, in a couple of them particularly, chaos reigned. So where do you start? Started with interviewing every member of staff and many students. What is the school like? What are the difficulties? What are the weaknesses? What are the strengths? Collated all the information, fed it back to the staff and the students, then asked, what sort of school do we want? What is our school going to be about? Then I put forward a proposal asking for volunteers to form a working group, not a working party, a working, tightly focused, time-limited working group. I wasn't interested in their status. I was interested in the broadest possible representation from all the staff. So we had caretaker, office staff, a lot of support, classroom assistants, as well as teaching staff. Sometimes we started off in some schools you had up to 50, and sometimes we agreed to whittle it down. A manageable group was around 20. They all had tasks to do. We came forward with a proposal for a change in ethos, behaviors for learning. That was presented, and this is all like weeks, sometimes months of work. And we all agreed all of this was very easy or impossible. It was easy if we all bought into it, we were all completely consistent, and impossible if we didn't. So I think, time up.
Yep.
That's a classic example, in my view, of how working with the research and the practical and the experience work together. And the one question I want to ask any student pursuing a doctorate, a PhD at the moment, is what impact is it going to have on the lives of our young people?
Thank you very much indeed. That brings another dimension to what we're looking at, in the sense of that notion of the conversations that can take place between colleagues, academic and practice, people Absolutely. In the schools, people in the colleges and so on. The power of the staff when you can mobilize it, the power of getting people in behind you, the importance of vision to the mission and so on. And that lovely idea, that lovely idea finishing off there in terms of the ethos and the way that you work on that. So thank you very much indeed for that. Cutting along, because I'm meant to keep everybody, you know, on track and get us out in time for the soup before it goes cold. So next is Dr. Joe Moynihan. Joe, it's over to you.
Thank you. Connor said I could be my own man, so I'm going to do just that. He mentioned accreditation, that I might speak to accreditation, which I think I'll skirt aside today, simply because in UCC we're about to face into some accreditation reviews, basically, in the coming months. But I won't bore you with that. Instead, I'm going to talk about something much more important. Fish. So here are a couple of very short, fun facts about fish. Did you know that there are over 32,000 species of fish, more than any other species on this planet? That's fact number one. Number two, did you know that most lipsticks contain fish scales? Fish scales. Sorry to announce that. And finally, and this is the important part, fish are very smart. One of the smartest creatures on this planet. If anybody knows Tomás O'Rourke, and I'm sure his colleagues, Carmel and Connor, will have seen the video he plays of the pufferfish, who creates this incredible geometric pattern on the floor to attract a mate. That just gives one example of how smart fish are. But fish don't respect boundaries. It's not in their reality. We set boundaries for fish. We put them in fish farms. We set fishing limits. But the fish don't respect those boundaries. So why am I talking about fish? I'm talking about fish because I was inspired by the cover of the Scotan's brochure for this conference. And when Dr. Noel Purdy talked about that, actually, I had been thinking about it during the week and wondering about the graphic itself. I'm wondering, while from a graphic design point of view, it's very, very good, and as a former art and design teacher, I feel I can say that, I looked at the fish out front and all the fish following along neatly. And there are lots of, if you Google leadership, you'll find lots of images just like that, with the fish out front and all the fish following behind. But I came across one recently, because I do a lot of searching for graphics. I'm into my PowerPoints and so on. And I found one quite similar, but the difference was the fish was right in the middle. He wasn't a different color, and he was swimming in the opposite direction. So my suggestion is that the kind of leader that anybody involved in school leadership or leadership in any organization should be thinking about? Do you need to be up front and having everybody follow? Or do you get into the center of what's happening and see if you can change the direction of the organization? In my talk yesterday, we talked about changing school culture and changing school climate. Very difficult thing to do, but it can be done. But where do you do that from? Where do you position yourself? And Langenhove and Harry have some great work around positioning and where we position ourselves and where we're positioned by others. So my big question really to you is, where should we position ourselves as leaders in any regard, in any organization? We make boundaries all the time, even for the fish. So my next question is, why do we do that? Why do we create these boundaries all the time? By the way, I think the graphic is also very inclusive. Lots of different colors, there was no color discrimination. Size, lots of different sizes and lots of different shapes. And finally, where do we want to position ourselves overall in education? And where do we want other people to position us? Hattie talks about variability among school teachers. There is also variability among school leaders. And does the leader make the organization or the school for that matter? That's my final question. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed. And in a sense, that concludes the semi-formal. And thank you all, colleagues, for staying within the limits of the time constraints. It's very difficult to do that. I've been on that side of the panel as well from time to time. It's not an easy thing to do. So at this point, we're opening up for conversation and questions. As I said earlier, it can be directed to the entire panel or it can be directed to an individual member of the panel. So, who would like to put the first ball into play? We have a potential speaker at the front. Okay. Thanks. Just wait, it's being taped, so we need the mic.
Really, it's just a comment, an observation. Thank you, panel, for all of those diverse comments. I find going away from the Scotland's conference that I'm going away with lots of ideas and more so maybe lots of questioning and self-questioning, even self-doubts. But I do have ringing in my ears still the word activist that came through, you know, with our keynote speaker. And I find myself, that it leads me to question teacher identity. And that concept of teacher identity, which we have spent a lot of time and got a lot of guidance and official guidance, you know, to consider. And I think teachers do understand that more. But I don't think activist fits into that concept, that it is more traditional. And I'm asking myself, you know, what I can do whenever I go back to my college to, you know, open our students' eyes to the fact that, firstly, actually they are very activist, that those teachers that are students who say to you, I came into this college because I want to make a difference. But that's the basis of the type of thinking that you want to encourage. But I think there's just so much, you know, confidence that we need to actually think of ourselves in that mode as teachers, as also activists. My own background.
That's actually a very, very good point. I mean, Colleen, would you like to respond to, anyone like to chase that down? What can we do to encourage people to see themselves more as activists as well as leaders? Is there something in that space you'd like to suggest? Two, please. Thank you.
Did you say
it's live? No, you can just lean forward and.
Is he just saying me? Yes. Okay. Yeah. Sorry. Actually, this is related to the comment I thought I would make at the end, but it really fits, I think, well with your question. One of my colleagues said to me after he read my book, I'm not going to say who it is. You'll know who it is. I mean, you would know if I said. A very senior person, and he said to me, you focus too much on equity. You ask too much of teachers and teacher educators. It's just going to be one more thing they'll fail at. And I think there are a couple things wrong with that response. One is it assumes that there's sort of a choice between being a regular teacher and doing the regular things, and then there's this other thing called being an activist or working for equity. And if you want to do that, you have to add it on. And it's too much. This is very consistent with Paul's point as well. The idea is being an activist is part of being a teacher. It's not an add-on. It's not a choice. That's a false choice, I think. I really think that the idea of being a teacher who is apolitical and neutral is a thing of the past. In this very unequal society that we live in, and our societies are unequal in different ways, depending on where we're from, but given that that's the world we live in, we have got to be activists and advocates, and we've got to join with other people to work harder at making schools and teacher education programs work for the people they don't work very well for. For immigrants, for people whose first language is not the language of instruction, for minoritized students and their families, for low income and poor families. So I think it has to be understood from the start that this is part of the work. Mm-hmm. Teaching is a political activity. Mm-hmm. So is teacher education, always has been. Sorry, is that too long?
No, not at all, perfect, thank you. Anybody else like to?
Just very briefly, again, connecting it to leadership and going back to what Paul said earlier during his presentation. And I think the onus is on every school leader, every middle manager, and every teacher and teacher leader to do right by others, which was the point that Paul made. And secondly, to fight for the rights and interests of all. And that's the entire school community, organizational community, and indeed the wider community. Thank you.
And indeed, it's, as Joe referred there, it's the positioning, and I'll come back to the principal, because as a former school principal myself, I'll come with that lens and with that hat on now, but where the fish is located, where that leader is, how that leader is or is not an activist in promoting justice and equity for all within the school, but also in having courage. And I think, excuse me, I think it means having the courage and the moral purpose to read in an activist way. And not to be afraid, okay, the fears are there, but to address the fears and to address the resistance and the fears with courage and moral purpose and to have the courage to be an activist in that regard.
That's fantastic, thank you.
When Paul was speaking, it was going through my mind, it's a bit like, I suppose, I mean, is there a need for revisiting or a consensus of the values or the moral purpose of what it means to actually be a teacher.
Yes.
For example, what was going through my mind was, you know, in the medical profession, it's the Hippocratic Oath. I'm there to uphold the Hippocratic Oath. So is there something like that that comes from within teaching that says, this is what it's about. Here's the core values of what I stand for. So therefore, it is a vocation, and in stepping into this vocation, here's the values and the things that I'm taking on, and therefore these are the things I'm here to uphold. So it becomes an integral part of being in that profession.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Yes, please. Just when the microphone comes to you, can you just briefly describe who you are? Yeah, that's fine. One and then two. No, it's fine. It's okay. We can go with that. Yeah, it's fine. Thank you, sir.
Okay. I think the interesting point here is you take a teacher who says, I'm so overworked, and every year I'm getting more work, and the government or institution that I'm in is paying me effectively less, making me work harder. It's everything I can do to meet my fundamental role as a teacher, okay? And to that person, they may, instead of thinking that activism is fundamental to the role of their teacher, of their role as a teacher, the perception is, oh, this is that extra add-on, and that I'm doing enough just by teaching reading and writing or something to that effect, and that's my contribution, which is not an activist conviction. I can't say that right. But so I think the question is, if you have a person, teacher or student, who says, I'm just so overburdened by everything else, what do you imagine is going on there? Is this an aspect of demoralization on the part of the teacher or student teacher? Is this some sort of consequence of exploitation by the powers that be? Or is it simply, the student is conceiving their role in perhaps just too limited a form to ever become inspired to a level of activism?
A complex set of questions, colleagues. I suppose a lot of it starts with that concept of the add-on and how we respond to teachers who respond to that as, not in my pay grade or whatever. Is that a fair kind of summary of the question? So, colleagues, again, anyone like to step to that?
I think that's an important question and an interesting tension that is very much out there. But as Marilyn said and other colleagues, that, teaching is about making a difference.
Yes.
And we must ask ourselves the question, what am I here for? Mm-hmm. And every morning we put our clothes on to go to work. We don't do that to go for the money. We do that because we want to go and make a difference. And of course, the money won't hurt, eh? But it's about making a difference. And I think we need to be honest with our students when they come to us. That this is what the profession is about. You're never going to be paid as much as you deserve, but you must keep at the center and at the forefront of your mind that is about making a difference, and every day you go there, you should try and make a difference, and whether you do that individually or in partnership. But if we do have huge amounts of teachers thinking that they can't or they won't engage in activism because it's above my pay grade or because I'm already overworked, then I think our society and our teacher education system is in trouble.
I would hate to think that anyone would see it as a bolt-on. I do remember when I became deputy in the big city school in Nottinghamshire. Nottingham is divided into two, Nottinghamshire and Nottingham City. At this point, I was in the Nottingham City, where we had all sorts of people from different backgrounds in the school. And I remember challenging the head on our equal opportunities policy, to which he replied, "Oh, I don't think we have time for that, Rosie." And I won't repeat the expletive I used, but basically the message was, it's not a bolt-on, it should be a fundamental part of your culture. And everyone should buy into it, should be expected to buy into it.
Yeah, and I would say he got that message very clearly.
It was.
Yeah, thank you. Anybody else on the panel like to take that? Okay, perhaps then we move to the next question. There was a raised hand here. And again, can I ask you please just to identify yourself before you ask your question? Thank you.
Hello, Martin Hagen from St. Mary's University College, Belfast. My question is maybe directed towards Lady Rosemary and to Joe in particular, and it draws on the fish analogy. To what extent do you think that leadership can be caught or taught, or to what extent do you think there is an innate or psychological or personality dimension which underpins and which is foundational to quality leadership?
Actually, that's probably a good question for all of the panel, but can we start with your chosen fish?
Yeah, it's a big question, you know, the whole notion. I love the little pun of being caught or taught. It's a huge question, not just in leadership, but obviously in many different walks of life. I think leadership is something that not everybody aspires to, and that's reflected very clearly in the number of people who apply for positions of senior leadership, the principal position in particular in post-primary. That's my background, hence I'm just referencing post-primary. But people are afraid of the fact that when you're the school principal, the buck stops with you. And I can remember having a discussion with my own staff some years back when I was making decisions, and decision making as a school leader is difficult to say the least, because there are so many stakeholders involved. And I found that I had to address staff in my first year because they were challenging me constantly because I was new in the job and so on. And one day I had to sit down and literally call an emergency staff meeting and address the issue that decisions are easy to make until you have to take responsibility for them. And that was intended to try and put a stop, it was a longer story, but to try and put a stop to this constant challenging of somebody who was trying to get into the middle like that other fish, trying to be in the middle of the staff to understand where they're coming from, where they're going, what their responsibilities are. And that connects to the previous question too, the whole notion of responsibility. And yesterday Marilyn referred to responsibility in place of accountability and the expression intelligent professional responsibility. And I think that's key. So it's not for the faint-hearted. Leadership is not for the faint-hearted. I don't think you're a born leader. I think it's something you grow up with. It's your own life experiences all coming together. It's something that you either have an appetite for or you don't. I know in my case, it was something I had an appetite for a very long time, and I wanted to be the school leader, not just any school leader, but in my school. And now I'm privileged to work with aspiring school leaders and kind of share that. And I would say to them, yes, you don't have to be a born leader. You can become a leader through your own experiences, through your own learning, through your own activism, advocacy, and determination. I hope that addresses your question to some extent.
And if anyone else would like to respond.
In my view, leaders have a responsibility to grow leaders within their schools. You know, the Fullen, Michael Fullen, Your worth as a leader is judged by those leaders you leave behind and who actually probably move the school even further than you did. I don't know about that. I think it's irrelevant whether they're born or made. It's damned hard work, and it's nobody ever gets it right. It's a work in progress all the time. And the minute you think you've cracked it, it's time to retire because you're not growing. And you learn as much from your newly qualified teacher as a leader. And one of the things I always did was had continuous professional development on leadership, which again was open to all staff to attend. There were twilight sessions, and newly qualified teachers were as welcome as the caretaker or anybody else. And they learned all about the school budget, staffing and staffing costs, and just learned how a school runs. And I always found that a useful way to grow leaders, apart from all the other ways you do it in a school.
Thank you. Anybody else want to?
Yeah, I just wanted to pick up on that one. Just to say that, and to add a little bit of theoretical context to this. At the moment, there are over 200 definitions of leadership and over 70 theories. So I definitely get your point about the field being contested. And so at the beginning of this thing called leadership, we had the great man theory, which said it, men are leaders, and so women were banished from leadership roles. But the field has evolved later to traits, you know, so you were born with certain traits, and if you didn't have those traits, you're not a leader. Then the field later evolved to situational leadership, and so it was a situation you were in that made you a leader. Then that was disproved, and it was the behavioral school which emerged to say, well, actually, it's about what you do that makes you a leader, rather than the traits or the situation. Mm-hmm. And then the contingent model of leadership emerged that says, well, actually, it's the environment that makes you the leader. So you can be in an environment that doesn't demand you to show leadership, but you can be in another one. And so it's, you know, it's your leadership is contingent upon that. And then the field has evolved to this concept now of postmodern leadership, in which we have transactional, transformational, situated, contextual. So what I'm trying to say is that the field has evolved, and where we are now is that it's leadership is about a combination of influences rather than any one particular situation, trait, behavior, or environment.
And a variety of styles to suit the occasion.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's a nice combination, that question of bringing in the styles as well, and that there's not just leadership, there are shades of leadership that are needed in different ways at different times, and we get a strong sense of that, I think, from the responses so far. We have time for maybe one or perhaps two questions more. Would anyone like to there's a hand raised at the back. Again, can you identify yourself, and can you keep the question pretty tight in terms of whether it's to the full panel or to an individual?
Okay, my name is Dervla Dupuir, and I'm an experienced school leader who now identifies as a teacher educator. And I suppose my question is really related to my personal experience as a school leader. So I think that we've had a very good outline of the development of leadership theory. And I just want to bring it right back again to the person of the leader. And the question is about the person of the leader and the importance of the person of the leader and the leader's own philosophy. But in order to kind of frame that question, I just made a few notes because, Joe, you asked, as a leader, where do you position yourself? And I suppose, as a school leader, I positioned myself from, first of all, I figured it out in my heart, and then I read it in the theoretical books. So I positioned myself, first of all, I positioned myself, and this was 15 years ago, as a leader among leaders. I always believed that to lead in a school community is to serve others, and then to describe myself as the hub of a bicycle wheel. And that's where I would have positioned myself as a leader. So that's just in terms of the framing the question and putting the person back into the theory. And also that I think that leadership, when you say it's a combination of things, I think now it's a way of being in the world linked to your own identity and values and beliefs. And that I also, two other things that really informed my leadership of the school. One was that, and these are from the literature, one, in order to lead learning, you need to be the lead learner. And the second is the concept of invitational leadership, where before you invite others to participate, to change or to change the school culture, you must first invite yourself. So there's a lot of information there, but the question is the person of the leader in the theoretical frame.
A very, very good question, and perhaps probably as good a one to finish on as any. So where is the person within your frame when it comes to concepts of leader and leadership? And then we'll go to the final, perhaps, comment from each panel member. Anyone like to take that specifically, the first one? Where is the person in all of this?
I can take that one.
Thank you.
I'm going to plug a book here, my recent book called The Nature of School Leadership. Chapter one of the book talks about leadership is a uniquely personal activity. The whole chapter is dedicated to the concept of leadership is personal. And within that chapter, I draw down on some work that my colleague and I, Disraeli Hutton, have produced. We developed in 2014 this model of leadership called situated leadership. So it's one of those 70 theories of leadership out there.
71.
Yes, 71. And in that model we of situated leadership, we have a formulae, and the formulae is L, leadership, equals F, which is a function, so small f, bracket, P, and a small f, plus E and a small f, and close the bracket. So essentially, leadership is a function of personal factors and environmental factors. And the environmental factors are divided into two parts, the institutional factors and the non-institutional factors. But what you can see is that the person is always rubbing up amongst the institutional and the environmental factors. And therefore, that is what produces the quality and the uniqueness of that leadership experience, or what we describe in the book as the intensity of leadership.
Yeah, I suppose I've just in summing up this whole emphasis and theme now, and increasingly view around the importance of school leadership right across the, not just from an organisation, but then I sort of was writing down, for me, what I think are the main big challenges that the development of this leadership is going to bring. So it's things like, I think one of the big things is about letting go. And what I mean by letting go, I think this is more about, you know, the relationship between the school and maybe the employing authorities or even the policy makers, which is moving away from, you know, I think we'd all agree you're monitored to death and the focus on, you know, certain standards and if you like, consistency of output, down to letting go to saying it's about partnership working and what's the school deciding, what is the output going to be, what are the outcomes. So it's a bit more about partnership type working. Looking at outcomes, I think the other challenge is one of accountability, because accountability, you know, goes with being a professional. I touched on already capacity building that is needed. I think there's structural change that is needed as well. And I think the other important thing is recognition of leadership. I mean, as I see it in the profession at the minute, the recognition of leadership is if you go into management. But people don't choose to go into management, and very, very good leaders. So what is the recognition? And it's not necessarily monetary, but so what is it's a recognition challenge in there. And I suppose the other challenge at professional, which is, as we've touched upon in this panel and every member, leadership is inherent in being a teacher. It's inherent. And therefore, there's, I think, professional challenges there, people recognizing that. But so it's just some of the things I think that will increasingly be the questions that we need to ask and to address.
That's very, very useful indeed, Sam. Thank you for that. Colleagues, as you know, we have the final tradition. We share with our Scottish colleagues to a certain extent when it comes to language and cultures and so on. And there's one tradition, I suppose, that we have adhered to down the years, which is the Joch an Doirse, which means the last drink that you have before you leave. This is our Joch an Doirse. This is our last few thoughts, observations, comments in relation to this incredibly convoluted concept of leadership from the many different perspectives we've had from the panel. Traditionally, we also take it in the same sequence that the panel speakers speak initially. So, Sam, you are first for your Joch an Doirse. Can you talk to us and tell us what your final thought for today is on the topic of our conference?
I just, for me, think it's about, there's a lot of work to be done in, I don't like standards, and I don't like the term standards, but a lot about competency and the development of competency and the competency of leadership, and a bit about defining within it what are those core competencies, and then how do you actually develop those, and that will bring in, you know, from linking back to what TCI showed up in their COSAN framework, all those aspects of professional development.
Thank you. And next then will be in the order of the programme, Margaret.
Yes, indeed, leadership is complex. It is a complex phenomenon, but school leadership is a privilege. It's a privilege to be a school leader and to shape the lives of children, but you know, students, but also of other teachers. And I think it's very much, as a former school principal, it's about unleashing the leadership capacity within the school. Voice for everybody, voice for every teacher and for every student and for the wider community of stakeholders within the school. I liked what Paul said earlier about the school in the community, but the community in the school. And that's very much the essence of what it is. But it's about a school principal the leader of the school, who really is the pre of Ida, or the primus inter pares, the lead teacher, having the courage, and I come back to courage, to unleash that leadership capacity, to let go of the reins, to encourage and develop leadership, and to have reflective, critically reflective conversations and dialogue, so that all agents can have voice and interrogate that concept of leadership. Because we have many people who apply for a promotional post, assistant principal posts within our secondary schools, who have not a conceptualization of what it means to be an assistant principal, of what it is to be a leader. In fact, they don't conceptualize themselves as leaders within the classroom. So it's about unleashing that and coming to what I would call as well, Paul, another form of leadership, which is the distributed leadership. How we distribute, and that it's not just rhetoric or a discourse. It's a new form of discourse, but what does it really mean? And what do we as school leaders mean by and enact distributed leadership in our school communities?
That's fantastic. Thank you very much. Lady Rosemary, final thoughts.
Just in one final word, if I think it's fundamental that every school leader should have a passionate interest, a passionate commitment to the rights of the young people.
Thank you. Thank you indeed. And then Joe.
I guess just reflecting the very last question, identity is key in leadership. And I'd have to say the person is certainly at the core. And a leader often has to wear different identities in his or her role in leadership. But nonetheless, the person is at the center of all of that. And a comment I make regularly to my leadership, educational leadership students, is that leadership is not about you, it's about people. It's all about people. And it entirely depends upon two words, trust and respect. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. Professor Marlin.
I just want to say I appreciate that a number of the things I talked about yesterday seem to have resonated with folks, and I've heard people mention some of those ideas, so I'm heartened by that. The one concept that many people seem to have congealed around is the idea of thin equity and strong equity. Mm. I've heard a number of people mention that. So I just wanted to finish with emphasizing that I think it's, I'm worried about that distinction, because I think it's going to be awfully easy for people to say, oh yeah, we're doing strong equity because we're working on fairness, or we're giving everybody equal access. But if you're not focusing on, at the same time, on the larger structural and systemic issues, and if you're not unpacking and focusing on powerful frames that are inside of all of us, we have internalized these frames about meritocracy and individualism, then you're probably not at strong equity. And I think strong equity is a really difficult challenge for all of us. So I just want to close with that. I'm thrilled that people resonated with those concepts, and I want to keep them as rich as I think they are. So
thank you very much indeed. And Professor Paul, final words.
Thank you, sir. I have three quick observations, colleagues, and I want to pick up on something Sam said about competences. And I, in my other hat, in my Commonwealth hat, I'm president of the Commonwealth Council for Education and Administration and Management. So we're working across 27 countries of the Commonwealth to develop leadership capabilities for head teachers. And we recently, with funding from the Commonwealth Secretariat in London, produced the Commonwealth School Leadership Capabilities Framework. And we struggled with what to call it. Whether we call it standards, whether we call it competences, but in the end we call it capability framework, because we felt like standard was something you attain and that was it, competences was something you do and that was it. But we said, well, the capabilities framework allows you to be emergent, because there's always more to learn and more to do. And so that is what we have called it. So thanks for pointing me to that, Sam. The second observation I want to make is that my work across big systems across the world, including the book, The Nature of School Leadership, has found a couple of things in educational leadership. Four main things, accountability and improvement, leadership preparation and development, school funding, so more is being demanded from less, and equity issues such as migration are big on the agenda of schools. So we have to think about those in our planning and our doing of school leadership. And then finally is a huge shout out to Scotans. It's my first time in Ireland and my first time to this conference, and I just think this is such an interesting setup you've got here, you know, Scotans and the Journal of Cross-Border Studies, you know, brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. And I hope that you can package this out, you know, the impact of Scotans and the history and the development, because there's a real story there to be told, and not only across Ireland, but in other parts of the world, in the Koreas where there's still a north and a south, and in India and other parts of the world. So I really, really want to commend all of you on this great work that you're doing.
That's probably... And that's probably as good a note to finish the panel on as any. Can I just warn you, Paul, Scotland's is contagious. People do come back. I know another accidental traveller who came for half an hour to a Scotland's conference once. His name was Professor John Furlong. And he has come back consistently. It's not Marilyn's first trip to our conference either. So, you know, we do hope that we will see you as one of our Scotland's friends in the future. Colleagues, thank you all for staying for the panel session. I'm going to hand over to Dr. Dr. Noel Purdy to shut the shop officially. But before I do so, can I ask you to put your hands together, please, and thank the panel for what's been an intriguing session.